This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
How to overcome problems. One of the things that many people find is that they practice for long periods of time, and sometimes the meditation kind of stagnates. And they're wondering what's happening with my meditation. How come I'm not moving forward more? How come I'm not making any progress? And so they want to find out what might be the reasons why progress stops on this path. How perhaps we can give the meditation a bit of an oomph, a bit of extra rocket fuel, in the meditation practice, and to see how we can make it develop better. And there's no such thing as going too fast, right? There's certainly such a thing as going too slow, but going too fast is really not really possible, except if it is wrong practice. But otherwise, we want to kind of get the practice moving here. And I just heard a story earlier on today. The story came from the Bhikkhunis. The Venerable Nun over here that told me this story. I said that there was a monk. This monk and said, I've been practicing this meditation object for the last 20 years. It's all the same. Nothing has happened in 20 years there. And this monk said, well, maybe you should investigate a little bit. Yeah, because if you stagnate like that, you need to investigate to find out what's going on. Otherwise, you're wasting your time just sitting there, not getting anywhere, nothing happening. Yeah. That's not the way to do the meditation practice. And of course, that's true. Yeah, if there is a problem, not going anywhere, it is quite right. We need to investigate that. But the question is, how do we investigate that? It's easy to say investigate, but sometimes we need a bit of guidance. What do we need to look for? What are the issues? And these are things that the Buddha actually does talk about in the suttas, in the discourses. He talks about the problems with the feedback. He does talk about the problems, and he talks about how to deal with these issues as they arise. So this is what I'm going to talk about today, and give you a chance to ask questions at the end if you wish. So one of the things you will have noticed as we started out or as we finished this meditation is that I said to look back on the meditation that you had just now to see if it worked, to see if you made any progress, to see, and if it didn't go well, what was kind of the reason for that. And this is one way of understanding your meditation, one way of kind of clearing away some of the hindrances and problems, learning from the meditation itself. Very often, this is one of the things I learned from Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm is my teacher. Anyone here, I was going to say anyone here who has heard of Ajahn Brahm, but anyone here who has not heard of Ajahn Brahm? Everyone heard of Ajahn Brahm? One over there. Okay, so good. So at least one person will not have heard this before. I feel kind of that's handy. So Ajahn Brahm is my teacher in Australia, one of the kind of very well-known Buddhist monks around the world. So what are I going to say now? What am I going to say? A mixture of tiredness and whatever. The problem, that's what I was going to say. So Ajahn Brahm always says, instead of learning from our failures, it's much better to learn from our successes. The reason for that, of course, is learning from success, meaning you're learning from a positive thing, and you have a kind of positive reinforcement of what you're doing. And that is why, at the end of your meditation, look back. Do you feel more peaceful? Do you feel like some kind of positive thing has happened in your mind? You're more mindful, you're more aware, and you feel more positive? Some kind of positive development in your mind? Ask yourself why that is the case. What has actually happened? And the answer to this kind of question is usually extremely simple. It's very easy to see what is happening. And one of the things that will have happened is that your attitude happened to be right at this particular time. A all the time you have had the wrong attitude. And now suddenly you've got the attitude in the right way. So what is the right attitude? Well, you will, the right attitude is basically having a positive feeling in the situation right here now. You're not negative, you're not kind of sad about anything, but you have a positive feeling. You're in good company, you're enjoying what you're doing, you have a good relationship with the breath, you have a good relationship with yourself. Yeah, very important, obviously. And when you have all of those things kind of coming together, that is when meditation starts to work. And you will see that if you focus on these things. So being aware of these things is very important. So when you investigate your meditation, ask yourself these very simple questions. Look for simple answers to those questions, because the answers on the spiritual path are usually very simple answers. If the answer is too complicated or the question is too complex, usually we're not going to get anywhere, because actually complex things don't usually work in the spiritual life. Simple things are the things that work on the spiritual path. So you will notice on the one hand you have a kind of good attitude. On the other hand, what you will notice is that you are letting go. Suddenly you get the idea of letting go, right? It's kind of this fascinating thing. We always try. People always say that, oh, I'm just always trying to let go. But how do you let go? I try. Well, the trying is the problem, right? Because the trying is the opposite of letting go. Letting go just means to allow things to be. And suddenly one day, you're just relaxing, sitting back, and suddenly the meditation works. And you will realize that what happened is that you're just relaxing, really, just allowing yourself to be. You're not doing anything. So one of the kind of basic ideas of meditation is that really what we're doing is like relaxing. You come home from work. I don't know what it is like for you, whether you work really hard. You probably work really hard, I can imagine. This is Silicon Valley. Everyone is supposed to work really hard. That's what we read in the newspapers overseas. Are those rumors correct? Okay, yes, people are nodding. I guess the rumors are correct. So when you work really hard and you kind of always applying yourself, always doing things, when you come back from work, after all this application, you're going to be quite tired very often. And when you're tired, you may feel like, I just want to lie down on my bed or on my sofa or sit down in my favorite armchair. And when you sit down after a long day's work, what do you do? Do you do anything or do you just relax? You just relax, right? Because that's kind of the point of relaxing after work. And meditation is a bit like that. It's learning to sit back, learning to really relax. And that is actually, so it's a very simple thing. And then, so look at that in your meditation practice. Learn from your successes. And you will see this very basic thing that sometimes you get right, other times you don't. But that is learning from the actual meditation. But I also want to talk a little bit more about how the Buddha talks about meditation and what are the foundation things that we need to put into place for meditation to work. And one of these things that you will find in the suttas, one of the very interesting things that the Buddha says, and this is found in a place called the Satipatthana Sangyutta. These are the connected discourses on Satipatthana practice. Satipatthana practice is the kind of main idea of meditation in the suttas, and Satipatthana practice is fulfilled by mindfulness of breathing. So mindfulness of breathing is really the number one meditation practice of the Buddha, and because that's what the Buddha recommended, I would recommend you to try mindfulness of breathing. So what does the Buddha say? And in this particular sutta, in the Satipatthana Sangyutta, I think it's sutta number 3 or 4 or something, called the Bhikkhu Sutta, which means the monk sutta. So this is about a monk. A monk is meditating. And the Buddha, this monk goes to the Buddha and he said, Venerable Sir, or Sir, please, could you please teach me a meditation technique? What should I do so I can kind of go into solitude and practice meditation for myself? And the Buddha replies, well, you should practice these 4 Satipatthanas. And you should practice them based on 2 things. 2 things are the foundation for that Satipatthana practice. So this is kind of interesting, because if these things are the foundations, it means that these are the things that you have to put into place for the meditation to work. So what are these 2 things? Do you know what they are? No need to answer. It's a rhetorical question there. You know what they are? I'm just pausing a bit, because if you pause a bit, then you have to think about it, right? What are those two things? What might they be? Now, a good place to start to guess what these two things might be is the Noble Eightfold Path, right? Noble Eightfold Path before Satipatthana, there are six factors. Is it possible to summarize those six factors into two? Maybe it is. And the way to summarize those first six factors of the Noble Eightfold Path into two is, first of all, right view. Yeah, in this case called Ujjukaditti, straight view, or correct view, if you like. And on the other hand, you have the idea of sila, you have the idea of morality. So meditation practice, the idea of Satipatthana, is founded on these two things. These are the foundations of Satipatthana practice. Right view on the one hand, and sila, or morality, on the other hand. That's kind of interesting. Okay, maybe you understand morality, because morality, if you think about the connection between morality and meditation, actually there's a very strong connection there. And there's a strong connection for many reasons. But one of the main reasons is because if you live a good life, and especially if you define morality in a very broad way, so as to include all your conduct, both positive and negative, you will feel good about yourself. Yeah, if you live well, if you're kind to other people, if you speak in a good way, if you think well about other people, if you have compassionate understanding, you tend to feel good about yourself. And you feel that you have a sense of self-worth, a sense of self-esteem. You don't complain about yourself. And that is a very valuable thing to have. And then when you go back to meditate, because you feel good in the present, it is easy to be present. Yeah, why does the mind always go into the future and the past? Why does it fantasize about a billion things? Or maybe not a billion, but, you know, a large number of things. Why is that? And the answer, of course, is because the mind is not really happy here. It wouldn't go into the future past. It wouldn't fantasize if the present moment was the pleasant moment. The catchphrase from Ajahn Brahm, by the way, make the present moment the pleasant moment. Not catchphrase, yeah? Remember that one. If all you get from today, make the present moment the pleasant moment. So this is how you do it. Because you are living well, because you're treating other people well, you start to be able to be present without really having to force that presence of the mind. And when you don't have to force the presence of the mind, if you are naturally mindful, then what happens is that you are just enjoying the meditation. You're sitting back, no willpower is required. You are just here, the breath is here, and you're doing mindfulness of breathing, and it's no big deal. So that's kind of obvious, yeah, that we have to have sila, we have to have the morality into place, and it needs to be defined very, very broadly. Buddhist morality is very profound, yeah, and there's always kind of more that we can do on the path of Buddhist morality because it is so profound. And please don't fall into the trap of complaining about yourself or thinking that you're not good enough. Please never think like that. I guarantee that everyone here is a very good person. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here, right? What's the point of being here if you're not already reasonably good? Usually, I ask at this point any bad people here, but not going to ask today because I know it's a waste of time asking these questions. Nobody raises their hand anyway, which is good. People are good in these kind of crowds. So you're already doing really well, but the bar in Buddhism for being a really high quality morality is a very high bar to clear. There's always more you can do. Yeah, you can always improve your sense of metta. You can reduce a sense of ill will a little bit. Yeah, everyone has more. Most people have more ill will than they would like to have. We can reduce our desires a little bit. We can always improve our speech, maybe even more. Yeah, even more gentle speech, even more kind. Little things that we can do to become even better people. So that is basically one of those fundamental things on the Buddhist path. Purify that, meditation is going to come together. But what is interesting about this little sutta is that it's not just about morality, which most people understand, but it's also about right view. Yeah, and in a sense, we can kind of understand why right view is at the very beginning of the path of practice, because without right view, well, you're not going to do anything. Yeah, who is going to even want to be moral if you haven't got some kind of right view that morality is important, that kindness works, and these kind of things. So in that sense, it kind of makes it sort of makes sense that you have to have right view at the beginning of the spiritual path. But what is interesting here is the idea that right view actually is a support for meditation practice itself. That's kind of fascinating, right? What is the connection between right view and meditation? And very simply, before I go into more details about this, hopefully I get into some more details later on, but very simply, the idea of right view in Buddhism, often we talk about right view being things like, you know, rebirth and karma, and sometimes we expand it out to kind of a large number of factors like generosity is good, and there are results, good and bad results of good and bad actions, and, you know, there are awakened beings in this world, and these kind of things. So right view can have many, many different aspects to it. But right view can be boiled down to one thing, one issue really. And once you understand that, you understand why it is so important for meditation practice. So what does right view boil down to? It boils down to the very simple idea of understanding where to find happiness and where to find suffering. Where not to find happiness and where not to find suffering. Understanding where happiness is to be found in the world. That is really what right view boils down to. And of course, what the Buddha is saying about the spiritual path is that if you really want to find happiness, if you want to find real satisfaction, you're going to find that in meditation practice. You're going to find it on the spiritual path. You're not going to find it in the world because the world is so unreliable. It is so uncertain. You never know what's going to do next. If you want to find it, it's going to be on the spiritual path. So if you have that kind of right view, and you understand the meaning of this, why that actually is the case, why it is that the spiritual path will give the satisfaction which the world never will, if you get that, of course, the mind is going to incline towards meditation. When you sit down, the mind is going to be like a nice dog. Yeah, you said to the dog, come this way, and the dog says, yes, sir, and tick, 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 it comes there. And your mind is like a dog, very obedient. That's exactly what you say. And because it understands where the bone is. The bone is over there. The happiness is over here. So the dog kind of follows along here. So understanding happiness and suffering is really one of the critical issues that causes the mind to then follow along in the right way and be able to watch the breath or whatever meditation object that you want to watch. Does that make sense to everyone? I'm glad, because sometimes I speak, I know it makes sense to me. I have no idea what the audience thinks. I'm very glad that you are nodding your heads. It's often like that, right? You speak, it knows everything, and the audience hasn't got a clue what's happening. But anyway, so hopefully we kind of have a bit more meeting of minds, which is always useful. So that is kind of the introductory sutta. This is the Sanyutta Nikaya, Satipatthana Sanyutta. I think it's sutta number 3. I don't know if you are into the suttas. I really enjoy the suttas. I have a mug. In Makuti. Makuti is like my little hut in the forest. This is in Australia, outside Perth. I have a mug. On that mug, it says, I love suttas. And then I have my tea, and I drink kind of, and I kind of read, I love suttas, and I have my tea. That's really nice. Someone gave me that mug. Isn't that nice? They knew about me already. So, okay, here is a mug. I said, wow, that's a really nice mug. So if you want to give someone here a nice mug, maybe if you want to give Shaila a nice gift for her birthday, a mug which says, I love suttas. I hope she didn't hear that, otherwise it's not going to be fun. But did you hear that, Shaila? No. Okay, good. All right. So that is the first kind of exhibition, sutta number one, the Bhikkhu Sutta. My second sutta I want to talk about is called the Chetana Sutta. The Chetana means like intention or volition or will or choice or something like that. And this is found in the Anguttara Nikaya Numerical Discourses, the 10th chapter on tens. That's the sutta number 3. Number 3, Chetana Sutta, on volition or will. And this is another sutta which explains the process of meditation. And this is why it is so interesting. And every time I teach a retreat, I always teach this sutta. So that's so, not always maybe, but 90% of the time. So how does this sutta go? And how this sutta goes, it starts off with morality. I just said now that morality is the foundation for meditation practice. So it starts off with morality. It should be no surprise, having seen this other sutta. From morality, it then goes to morality causes
non-regret.
Makes sense, right? If you are really moral, you have no regrets. And what is the connection between morality and non-regret? And this is where it is interesting. Yeah. Well, let me go through the factors first of all. I'll tell you the connection afterwards. But there's a causal connection, one thing leading to the next one. From morality comes no regret. From no regrets comes something called pamudja in Pali. Pamudja means like gladness. Yeah. Gladness or joy. From pamudja, from gladness, comes piti. Piti is like rapture. It's like kind of energy in the body, like happy energy, rapturous energy in the body. From piti comes prasadi. Prasadi is like tranquility or calm. Yeah, you become incredibly calm and peaceful. And hopefully you have some of those experiences of meditation sometimes. From that calm comes sukha. Sukha is bliss. Yeah, so gladness, rapture, tranquility, bliss. That sounds good. Do you want to be a Buddhist? It's like when I read this, I think, yeah, I'm a Buddhist. This is what I'm here for, right? Bliss. And from bliss comes samadhi. Samadhi is like the deep meditation, right? The jhanas and these kind of things. From the samadhi comes then seeing things in accordance with reality. Yeah, which is kind of the ultimate aim of Buddhism, is seeing things with insight there. And then it goes further all the way to awakening down the track. But let's stop there. That's plenty enough already. Yeah. So this is already an extraordinary sequence when you think about it. There's so much happiness there. There's bliss all the way down the track, from the beginning all the way to the end. And this is what Buddhist meditation really is about. Yeah, the enjoyment, the idea of having something very profound. And what is so fantastic about this is that all that bliss, all that tranquility, all that collection of the mind that you have in this way, it is pregnant with insight. Yeah, insight comes along with it. One of the very important things to understand about the Buddhist path is that there is no real distinction between samatha and vipassana, calm and insight. This is Mara disturbing us. Mara, we see you. When you say Mara, we're supposed to disappear. We're still carrying on. Okay, he has been seen as going away now. All of these things, insight and samatha and vipassana, insight or clear seeing and calm, always go together on the Buddhist path. And the more you kind of read the suttas, the more you understand the word of the Buddha, you understand that this is true. And very often you find that the suttas are expressed, you find the compound, samatha, vipassana, like in one word, kind of makes the point that they go together. Samatha, vipassana develops together. If you have one side of this, the other side comes along. So it's not really separate. So when you think that kind of I just talk samatha, no. Samatha and vipassana go together. So this is the first thing about this sutta, which is very fascinating. But the next thing, which is even more interesting, how is it? What is the link between these steps, right? I'm just saying that there is a causal link, one thing leading to the next one. But what exactly is that causality? And the Pali word for this causality that goes between the links. So what the Buddha says there, he says that going from one to the next one is na chetanaya karaniya. How good is your Pali? Na is not, right? Chetanaya, chetana is intention of will of volition. Karaniya means not to be done. Not to be done by the will. Not to be done by intention. And then he says, it is dhammata. Dhammata means, it's like dhamma. Dhamma means nature, right? It means like it's lawful. It is accordance with nature that you go from one to the next one in this sequence. So that what the Buddha is saying is that this sequence is automatic. It happens by itself. It cannot be done by an act of will. It has to happen naturally. And of course, if you try to make nature happen, if you try to use your will to kind of get your fingers in there to kind of make nature happen, you can't make nature happen. Nature happens according to laws, according to certain causes and effects. So if you try to get your will in to make nature happen, you disturb the process. So you have to withdraw the will. You have to withdraw the doing. And then this process happens by itself. That is what the Buddha is saying here. So it's kind of extraordinary, right? And I remember I was, because I've been an Ajahn Brahm disciple for almost 30 years. I've been at this monastery in Australia for almost 30 years. It's hard to believe, but it's true. Huh? Feels like a very short time, right? It kind of goes, time goes so fast. And Ajahn Brahm always used to say, yeah, okay, you just sit back, you just relax, yeah? And then you relax, you close your eyes, you just wait. That's all you do. And when you wait like that, boom, samadhi just happens. And I said, sure, somebody just happens. I tried to do that. Nothing happens at all. My mind was all over the place. Yeah, fantasizing about things didn't really work at all. So, but of course, after a while, I started to read the suttas. And I started to say, well, this is actually exactly what the Buddha is saying. Yeah, all you do is you really relax. You don't do anything at all. And you wait, and these things happen by themselves. So Ajahn Brahm was right. So if Ajahn Brahm was right, but it didn't happen in my case, why was that the case? And this is the kind of thing that we should always ask ourselves. The questions why are incredibly important. And if you don't make progress, and if a meditation is stagnating, you should always investigate. You should always ask yourself why. And in this case, the answer actually is very obvious. Because you follow the sequence backwards, right? It started off with morality at the very beginning, with sila. That leads to non-regret. So the answer really is that your morality is not yet as powerful as it could be. And remember, I'm not here complaining about you saying that you are a bad person, right? You're already very good, but maybe it's possible to be even better. If you're not the Buddha yet, it's possible to be better, right? So remember that. And so we're trying here to kind of, the bar, this bar is very, very high. Very high one, a very low one, very high, very difficult to clear. You have to jump over, it's very high. So this is why it is difficult, yeah? So we need to always ask ourselves the minutiae of morality. Is it possible for me to have more metta? Can I have more compassion for the people around me? How can I understand people better so as to have more compassion and understanding? How can I turn my life into an act of giving? So I always give to other people. Whenever I open my mouth, it's a gift to the people around me. How can your word be a gift to the people around you? If you start thinking like that, there's almost no time, no moment during the day when you cannot give a gift to someone else. Yeah, because our words, if they are spoken in the right way, with gentleness, with meaning, with a sense of creating harmony in the community around us, saying something that goes to the heart of other people, and we can always do an act of generosity in our daily life at all times. And this is how we purify the morality. It's not just about not doing the bad things. It's about deliberately doing good things. And that is when you really start to feel happy about yourself, because you are deliberately living a life of good conduct. As you do that, this process starts to work. That is really what the Buddha is saying here. So this is another way of thinking about this, right? The idea of why morality is so incredibly important for this path to work. But I also want to talk a little bit more about the idea of right view, which is the other kind of leg of this thing here. And I'm going to approach this from the point of view of the five hindrances. Have you all heard about the five hindrances? Yeah? Wow, you're all very well educated. That's good. And if you haven't heard about them, you're going to hear about it now. So the five hindrances, according, these are the things that stop you from achieving deep samadhi, yeah, so deep meditation practice. And the first one is called, is usually translated as sensual desire. I don't think it's a very good translation. We will see shortly why it is not, but usually considered a sensual desire. Second one is ill will. Then we have like tiredness and lethargy. Then you have restlessness and remorse. And the last one is doubt. Yeah, so five hindrances. Now, so how should we think about these five hindrances? And the first thing to realize about these five hindrances is that there are two of these five are far more important than the other ones. And the two that are really important are the first two. Yeah? The last three of the five hindrances are in large part a result of the first two. Yeah, so if you have a lot of sensual desire, you can call that craving if you like. If you have a lot of craving, you're going to be restless, right? Because the craving mind is agitated, is restless. So by reducing the sensual desires, by reducing the craving, restlessness also tends to die down. If you had a lot of craving, or if you have ill will, that tires the mind out, because the restlessness and the agitation is very tiring. Yeah. And after a mind, you just fall asleep, right? If you get really angry with someone, but afterwards, sometimes you get very tired. It's kind of a very common experience. Or if you have a long day, you use your will a lot, which is related to the idea of craving. Yeah. You also feel tired because of all the activity in the mind. So again, that's also a result of the first two hindrances. And doubt also is actually connected with the first two, because the less you have of the first two, the clearer your mind tends to be, the less doubt you normally also will have. So the focus should be mostly on the first two hindrances. Yeah, this is the first thing I would recommend for you to do, unless your meditation is becoming incredibly profound. If your meditation is becoming very, very deep, and you're kind of approaching real samadhi, then the other three hindrances start to become more important. But for most people, the first two are by far the most important ones. So which one of the first two are most important? How do we deal with the first two? And to answer this question, there's two different ways of looking at this question. And the first one is to recognize that the most debilitating thing for meditation practice is ill will, right? If you have ill will, you are really far away from meditation, because a mind of ill will is a mind that is very troubled. It's a mind that is, you know, going in exactly the opposite way of kind of morality. Ill will is kind of an immoral state from a Buddhist point of view. It is agitated. It is not really happy, not enjoying what is going on. You are in the past very often because you're thinking about what someone did to you or said to you. How can they say that to me? Or whatever. And you get really upset or whatever. So ill will is basically, it's not the one problem in meditation. For that reason, we should focus on ill will the most. Yeah, because of that. So find some good strategies of dealing with ill will. I'm going to give you a very simple strategy right now how to deal with it. And that is to remember that all the people around you, they are more like robots than autonomous beings. Yeah, look at the people around you and say, okay, robot one, robot two, robot three, right? Are you going to get angry with robots, or are you going to forgive the robots in your life? Okay, you're a robot, I forgive you, right? You don't know what you're doing. A robot is kind of running on the program, right? And a robot is conditioned by that program in the same way we are conditioned by our programs. What is your program? Your program is all the conditioning that happened when you were a child, when you were a youth, when you went to school, when you went to university, when you're working in Silicon Valley, whatever it is, all of that is the program that is working on you. Actually, it is much worse than that, because the real program also comes from past lives. So many of the things that are your character traits, the habits that you are following now, very likely come from past lives. And whether you believe in past lives or not is still true. Sorry to say that, but that's the way it goes. So it is very deeply seated conditioning. And so when you look at people, remember they are largely like robots. If they treat you badly, it's not really because they want to treat you badly. In all likelihood, they want to treat you well. People actually want to be kind. I know I would like to be kind all the time, but sometimes I can't stop myself. Yeah, bad things happening in my mind. And I say, okay, I forgive myself. It's all right. It's just habits, bad habits, sure, but I forgive myself. And once you understand that these are bad habits arising in you, that you are not really all that responsible for these things, it's easy to forgive yourself. It's easy to forgive others. Then you find the solution to these things. So think of people like red traffic lights, yeah? You come around the corner, you're in a hurry to get to work, the traffic lights goes red, and maybe you get a bit irritated, and maybe you get a little bit kind of upset, but you don't kind of go over the top, yeah? You don't go out killing the traffic light. I hope you don't. Otherwise, we're going to have to lock you up somewhere. So, right? So people are like traffic lights in a sense. And remember that they're like robots. Once you understand that, once you understand the conditioning of people around you, then forgiveness becomes possible. Then you can actually have compassion for people, because you know that these people, including yourself, we're all trapped by our conditioning. And because we are trapped by our conditioning, actually, there's very good grounds for having compassion for every one of us. So you change This idea of being angry with other people, instead of getting upset for their faults, you have compassion for them. And that is actually very beautiful. Yeah, most of the time in this world, when someone does something bad towards us, they treat us in a bad way, they say a bad thing, because we tend to take these things personally. And that is the problem. We take it personally. We should never take it personally, because it never is personal. It's not about you. It's about the other person. And once you turn the table around and you don't take it personally, and you understand the problem is actually with the other person, at that moment, you can have compassion instead of getting upset. It's a slight change in perception. Yeah, it's something you have to work on to be able to make it work for you. But once you get that slight change in perception, you move from anger to compassion like that. Magic. Yeah. And this is how, to a very large extent, you can overcome almost all ill will in your life. But you have to keep on at it, keep on practicing it, and ill will doesn't arise anymore. So that is the ill will, yeah? So I'm going to come back next year, I'm going to check you out, I'm going to test you, I'm going to shout at you and see how you react. We're going to have an angerometer. Is there such a thing as an angerometer? See what happens. Maybe someone can invent that here in Silicon Valley. We'll ask for angerometers. We should have a Dhamma, some kind of Dhamma factory. Can do kind of high-tech Dhamma solutions. That is the second hindrance, of ill will. So what about the first one, which I just called sensual desire, first of all? Actually, the first one is the most important one. The reason why I started with ill will is because it is the most easy one to deal with, and because it causes the most havoc for meditation, right? So because of that, deal with ill will first, and then later on, come back to the problem of the sensory world. So the first one is called Kama Chanda in the Pali language. And really what it means desire in the realm of the five senses. That's really what it is referring to. Any kind of desire in the realm of the five senses. Yeah, this is what it is about. And this is an extraordinary, profound defilement of the mind. Because we are immersed in the five senses from the moment you wake up in the morning, the moment you go to bed at night. We're always in the realm of the five senses. Almost everything that we know. The only exception is sometimes you go on a meditation retreat, you have maybe a peaceful state of mind. At that time, you're starting to emerge, come out of that realm of the five senses. When you start to feel a bit of joy or rapture in the body in your meditation, that is where the beginning of the spiritual happiness starts. And that is where the five sense realm is starting to fade away. But for most of our lives, we are always caught in this realm of the five senses. It's always around us. So what we are trying on the Buddhist path, and this is why it's so hard, we're trying to let go of that realm that we're always part of, to go into something more profound, something deeper, and emerge on the other side into the realm of samadhi, the realm of the mind. This is what we're trying to do. And this is why it also is very, very hard. So this is not just about avoiding the cravings of the world, especially all the strong cravings. Of course, it is part of this as well. But it's actually emerging from all the attachments that we have in that world of the five senses. Letting go of the entire world of the five senses is really what we're trying to do. And so because we're trying to do this, we need some strategies that actually deal with this realm in a kind of broad way, right? Not just kind of some simple solution, which kind of sometimes people say, okay, if you have sensual desire, you just kind of contemplate the 31 parts of the body. 31 or 32? I said this. What was that? 32? 31? Okay, 31. Okay, 31. Wow. Okay, you have really been listening, right? That's really good. So 31. I'm not going to go into that now, but 31 or 32, there's a slight difference there. The difference is the brain, but let's leave that out for now. We'll come back to this later if you wish. But so that is one way of dealing with it. It's actually just a very kind of superficial way of dealing with immediate defilements. Yeah, when you have too much attraction to the body, letting go of that can work by doing that. But actually, we need something much more broad if we're going to be able to let go of the entire world of the five senses. And what are some of those broad contemplations that we can use? This is what I want to talk a little bit about, because this is, to me, is very interesting here. And one of these very broad contemplations that we can use to get rid of, or get let go of that entire world of the five senses there. And this is where the Buddha starts to talk about developing certain perceptions, yeah? And one of these perceptions that he talks about is what is called the Sabbaloke Anabirati Sanya. Sounds pretty cool, right? Sabbaloke, some kind of long Pali word. That always kind of sounds very impressive. The Sabbaloke Anabirati Sanya, what that means, it means the perception of non-delight in the entire world there. Yeah, the entire world. What is the entire world? Well, the entire world in this case is the world of the five senses. The world here is very often defined like that in the suttas. It can have different meanings, just like the world has different meanings in English. In the same way, in Pali, world is like that. But five senses is one way of thinking about the world. So the non-delight in the whole world. How can we do that? How can we have non-delight in the whole world? Now, we'll give you some very simple ideas on how to do this. Actually, there is so much free contemplation given to you through the news, for example, every day, right? I don't know if you where you get your news from, but wherever you get, maybe not wherever, but if you get your news from a reasonably reliable source, yeah, and that's, of course, that's another kind of interesting issue, but kind of irrelevant now. But if you get your news from kind of, you start to see that the world, there's a lot of bad things happening in the world, right? There's a war going on in Ukraine. So what do you think about the war in Ukraine? Is it good or bad? It's pretty bad, right? Most people would agree it's bad because people are dying and it's not good. Climate change, yeah? The world seems to be heading towards kind of really bad warming. I saw an interview with Bill Gates recently, and he was saying it looks like we're heading for 2.5 degrees of warming in the world. Yeah, that's what he was reckoning. I don't know how precise that is, but that was his idea. Yeah, 2.5 degrees may not sound as much like much, but we all know the consequences of that are very, very bad. And so you have all of these things happening around the world. You have all the political problems happening around the world. Yeah, with all the kind of nations becoming more hostile towards others, and all of these kind of things happening around the world. Refugees and more refugees happening in the world, with kind of people fleeing from Ukraine, causing all kind of problems everywhere. And it seems like the world is kind of moving in a bad direction. That's what it looks like. We don't know, but that's what it looks like right now. Who knows what's going to happen? And this is really for, if you are a Buddhist and you are a meditator, this is like free opportunity to kind of get head up with the whole world, right? This is what it is. So it's kind of fascinating. Some people will read the news and say, it's terrible. It's really bad news. But as a Buddhist meditator, you say, wow, I'm so fed up with all of that. Put it all to one side. I've given up trying to find a solution in the world. There is no blooming solution to this world. Put it all to one side. Get your meditation and find your refuge in the meditation practice instead. The reason we are so concerned about the world, the reason we don't like the war in Ukraine, the reason why we are scared of climate change, the reason why all of these things seem so terrible, is because we have a vested interest in that world. Yeah, because we find refuge in that world. You are finding your refuge in the wrong place. That is the problem. The Buddha makes it very clear in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta that where we should find our refuge is within. It is in meditation practice, because the world, even at the time of the Buddha, there was no climate change. Well, not in the way we have now anyway. There was no Ukraine war because Ukraine didn't exist. There were other wars, of course. Still, there was plenty enough suffering to be fed up with that world. The Buddha was going to pass away, all of these kinds of things, right? The world is always problematic, but now it is in our face. Yeah, there's the free kind of news. Take it on board. And it's easy to see what is going on. Use that as an impetus for the spiritual practice, then you are using all that world information in the right way. Then it has a positive effect. And again, it's this beautiful thing. Yeah, it's this marvelous thing. All that negativity that we kind of get for free for the news, we take that and we use it for a positive purpose, and we turn it into spiritual practice instead. It's magic. All the negative things in the world can be turned into a positive way if you think about it in the right way. Sure, there's always going to be a kind of a residue or kind of, you know, sadness that the world is going bad, maybe. Of course. But at least we do the very best and turn it into a positive direction instead. And this is the magic of the spiritual path, because the spiritual path is about moving away from the world, not taking the world so seriously. It enables us to look at things in an entirely new way. So that world, don't want to see it anymore. Yeah, just don't, that world is out of control. Enough. Meditation practice, yes, please. And then we come, and then we find some peace, and we find some refuge, and we find something positive in meditation practice instead. Am I talking nonsense, or does it make sense to people? I'm really concerned people will kind of start walking out soon. Because I'm not saying that we shouldn't care about the world. It's very important to understand that. I'm not saying, of course, we should care about the world. But we care about the world in a new way, without so much attachment, without so much holding on. Because we want to be moral people. We want to live well. So we care about the world, but we know that the outcome is uncertain. We know that we only have so much power to affect change in the world. We're only one person among 8 billion. So how much change can we expect to do? It's only little me against 8 billion people. Okay, I'll do my little thing, like giving a talk here. Yeah, what else can I do? I'm not sure. But close my eyes and meditate, maybe. These are the things I do, right? And I help the world a little bit by doing the right thing in the world. Yeah, voting for someone who kind of does something about climate change or whatever. Someone who has a good peace plan rather than a warmonger or whatever. So you do your little things in the world to kind of get things going in the right way. But we understand the limitations of that. And because we understand the limitations of that, we turn away from the world because we know the unreliability, the uncertainty of what's happening in this world around us. This is the Sabba Loke Anabirati Sanyata. Yeah, Sabba Loke Anabirati Sanya. Sabba Loke Anabirati. I'm going to test you next time I come here. Sabba Loke Anabirati Sanya. I don't know, I love these little things. It's kind of the suttas are so full of little phrases like this, things you can take out and you can use, but you have to understand what they really refer to. This is one way of dealing with the entire gamut of the sensory world in one go without having to kind of focus on individual problems or individual defilements or anything. Another way that I really would recommend you to do is to do some death contemplation. Is that all right? Yeah. Sometimes people say that, oh, I don't want to think about death. Yeah, please let me get out of here before you start talking about death. No, let's talk about death. And the Buddha says in the sutta, he says that there are certain contemplations that everyone should do. Yeah. And he specifically says, women and men, lay people and those gone forth. Yeah, specifically says that everyone should really look into this. And it's kind of interesting here. It says women and men. It doesn't say men and women. It says women and men. Yeah, and sometimes it's kind of fascinating because the suttas tend to be very kind of male-oriented, but not always, not in every kind of situation. And this is one of those strange areas where it actually says women first and men afterwards. That's kind of interesting. Yeah, not sure why that is the case. And I remember I was discussing with Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, one of the great treasures of American Buddhism, translated all the suttas into beautiful English prose. It's kind of really a pleasure to read the translation by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi because it's so beautiful. But still, you have to be careful, right? Because you have to... Anyway, let's not go there. So, and I was discussing with him, yeah? And he came to this passage, and it says that women iti va purisava, it is women and men in Pali language. And he had translated as men and women. And I said to him, but it doesn't say men and women, it says women and men. So why are you translating it as men and women? Because I was kind of giving him some feedback, yeah, some serious feedback. And so I said, isn't it nice that for once the women come first in the sutta, shouldn't we at least put them first? And he thought, yeah, maybe you have a point, yeah. And his argument was, well, in English, usually it's always men and women. That's kind of the sequence we normally have. You don't have to follow these kind of, you know, standard ways of doing it. Let's turn it around. And he came around to that. I was very pleased with myself. I was able to persuade him to change it around. Now it says women and men. Yeah, so I think these things, little things like that, actually make a little bit of difference because it makes us understand that things may not be quite as one-sided as they seem. Anyway, let's not go in too much into that debate, because that's going to take a long time. What are these things that we should reflect on? Yeah, and these things that we should reflect on, all of us, everyone, one of them is the death contemplation. Yeah, I will die for sure. I have not gone beyond dying. And it's a very, very powerful contemplation if it is done properly. Because the idea of dying is not just the fact that we're going to die, but it's also the fact that we don't know when we are going to die. We have no idea when it's going to happen. And it could be that you walk out on the street here afterwards. I've seen some of your crazy American drivers. Yes, kind of. Sometimes you see this kind of big, enormous cars. I've never seen cars this size before. There's nothing like that in Australia. Kind of people driving this look really dangerous, these cars. So you don't know what's going to happen next. Yeah, it is very uncertain. Or sometimes people just fall over because they have a heart attack or whatever. This is the reality of life. We have no idea what's going to happen next. And once you get that point, once you start to understand that actually we don't know how far, you know, what's going to happen next, it changes your attitude to life. It makes this world less important. Because if you are going to die on your next breath, how important are the material things in your life? Are you going to contemplate your next house, the next car you're going to buy, the next relationship you're going to get into? It all becomes irrelevant, right? This world doesn't matter so much anymore. If you imagine yourself on your deathbed, you know you have come to your deathbed. You're lying, and this is actually a very nice exercise, imagining yourself on your deathbed. What does it feel like to lie on a deathbed? But what it feels like is that nothing in this world is important anymore, right? Everything in this world becomes irrelevant. You just say goodbye to everything that is here. And what you're looking forward to is whatever is going to happen after you die. And if you have an idea of rebirth, well, okay, so now you're ready for that journey on into the future. That is what matters to you. And of course, at that point, because you're letting go of everything in this world, the only thing that you're carrying with you is the goodness in your heart, the qualities that you have built up over a lifetime. That is what we mean by kamma or karma. Yeah, are these qualities in our heart that we bring with us into the future? And that is why they affect your future rebirth, because these are the qualities that you see in the dying process. So there's something about the death contemplation that reminds you of what is really important in life. Everything in this world doesn't really matter. Yeah, this world is kind of irrelevant really in the big picture of things. Who cares about this world except for being kind, except for living well, except for helping other people also to see what really matters, what is important. So we start, our attitude to this world starts to change. Instead of thinking, what can I get out of this world? What can this world give me? And all of these things that are so incredibly impermanent and unreliable anyway, we start to ask the question, how can I live in this world? How can I live in a better way so as to ensure that I maximize all of these good qualities that will then support me also into the future? And by thinking like this, by using the death contemplation, you are losing the interest in the things of this world. You're abandoning so much of the stuff of this world that really we think is important. Craving dies down. And interest in pursuing all of these things in the world, whatever it might be, is not so important anymore. Your career, okay, it's good to have a career, but it doesn't matter all that much, right? You're going to die on your deathbed. Are you going to think about your career? Probably not. Yes, probably going to be completely irrelevant. What you're going to think about is how you treated other people. Because that is what remains in your heart. If you die with regret, please don't die with regret. It's painful to die with regret, right? Die without regret. Die with a good feeling within. That is the good way to die. So death contemplation is incredibly powerful in guiding us in the right way to remind us what really matters in this life, and then abandoning the first hindrance, and then using that for your meditation practice. In fact, one of the very interesting things about meditation is that it is very similar to the dying process.
Yeah, because in the dying process, what are we doing? Well, in the dying process, you are letting go of everything in this world, which is, as I said, exactly what we're trying to do in meditation practice, letting go. And also, when you die, you tend to be at peace because there's nothing much to do. Yeah, you just chill. You just relax. Okay, nothing to do. You just lie there. It's not as if you are excited or kind of trying very hard at anything when you're dying. Yeah, you're not doing anything. So you have this beautiful combination on the one hand of relaxing and letting go, coming together, which is so hard in meditation. Very often we try to let go. We're not able to combine the letting go with the relaxation. But on your deathbed, that is what happens. So use the deathbed contemplation as a way into meditation practice, because the process is very similar. Death and meditation are very similar to each other. So die in your meditation. Good practice anyway, right? You're going to have to die one day. Get into the practice now. But, you don't have to die yet, but at least you check it out, see what happens. And sometimes people think this is scary, but of course it's not scary at all. It actually just makes you peaceful. It just makes you feel really good about yourself. Because dying for a good person, dying is a beautiful process. You're just relaxing. You're just enjoying the path. You have lived well. There's nothing to fear. It's just enjoyable to die if you're a good person. So you learn to get into that now. And actually, this makes meditation possible. So these are a couple of ways, of using different ideas. I'm talking a lot. Time is going fast. But using ideas to let go of the world of the five senses. There's one more thing I will mention. There's many, many things I can mention because the suttas are full of really beautiful advice how to let go of the five sense world. But I will mention one more thing, and that's in the same sutta I'm talking about now, of these five ways that everyone should reflect on. So I said one way is the way of reflecting on death. Another one is reflecting on old age. Another one is reflecting on illness. The reflection on illness is the reflection when you go to the doctor. You should never say to the doctor, something is wrong with me. You should say, something is right with me, doctor. I'm sick again. And doctor thinks you are nuts and it sends you off to the psychiatrist. But it's true, right? Nothing has gone wrong when you are sick, because that's the nature of the body, to get sick. We get these things, this idea that you are supposed to be healthy. Well, that's actually a wrong idea. But anyway, that's a sidetrack. Then we have the contemplation of I am the owner of my karma. That's what I was talking about just now. You come to your deathbed, you bring the good qualities with you. And then there's a fourth one of these contemplations. And that is the contemplation that everything that is dear and agreeable to me in this world must be separated from me. It's another very powerful contemplation. And when you remind yourself that everything that is dear and agreeable in this world, what does that mean? Well, it means everything you own. It means all your relationships, the people who are closest to you. Your husband, your wife, your kids, your colleagues, your friends, your acquaintances. The monastics, Ajahn Brahm, that's right, I forgot about that. Ajahn Brahm going to have to die. I believe Ajahn Brahm, that's traumatic. How am I going to deal with that? Everything has to go. It's important, right? You tend to kind of hold on to things in life. Even when you become a monk, you let go of your parents a little bit, but then you hold on to another monk instead. That's kind of problematic. So you learn to see all of these relationships as inherently unreliable and uncertain. So much of your mental content, so much of who we take ourselves to be in the society. We all have a position, all have a status. How do you say status in American again? Status? All of these things have to go. So much of our mental content. When you die, it's almost like you're emptying all of these things out, because these things actually belong to this particular world, and you have to let go of it. Your physical body is going to have to go, right? Don't put too much effort into this physical body. It's going to be cremated. It's going to end up in a little pile of ashes. It's not worth all that hard work. So look after your physical body. Make sure you're okay. But don't overdo it, for goodness sake. People spend so much time in the gym kind of building themselves up, looking the part, looking And in the end, it's kind of, sometimes we wait, sit on the bottom instead and watch your breath, far more time, but better use than kind of, you know, going to the gym too much. So anyway, that's just my crazy idea, but that's it. Yeah, so we started to remember that all of these things are impermanent. All of these things are out of control. Everything beloved and pleasing in my life must become otherwise. And if you remind yourself of this again and again, and you really have to remind yourself again, what happens is that you start to detach a little bit and you start to understand the importance of the spiritual path. And what is very strange, and I think people often misunderstand this, I think that when you detach too much from the people around you, you become less caring, yeah, because you are detached. But that's not the kind of detachment I'm talking about. It's not the careless kind of attachment. What I'm talking about is a detachment where you are more free, you have more mindfulness, you have more ability to react in a good way. You actually become more loving, but in a more detached kind of way. Yeah, it's like you very often when we have kids, we expect our kids to behave in a certain way, especially when we are with strangers. If your kids behave wrongly, it reflects bad on you, right? That's because of your attachment. You want your kids to really kind of look good. Yeah, because it reflects on you, because you think you brought them up. Actually, you didn't bring them up. They have their own kind of background from some past life. Anyway, that's what we tend to think. But when you are more detached, you allow your kids to be more who they are. You don't think that they reflect you. They just reflect their own conduct. And then you have more ability to be kind in a neutral kind of way. You understand what is really in the best interest of the child. So more detachment leads to more ability to see clearly what actually is in the best interest of people around you. So when we detach in this way, when we understand the impermanence of everything around us, we don't become bad people. We become better people as a consequence. This is kind of the paradox of the spiritual path. Yeah. So actually it becomes very beautiful. So these are some of the contemplations I would recommend you to do. The Buddha recommends everyone to do these kind of contemplations. And one of the powerful consequences of this is really what I mean by establishing right view. Yeah, because it shows you where suffering is to be had and where happiness is to be had. This is why this is right view. It's a different way of thinking about right view than you may be used to. But it is an outlook. It's a way of appreciating the world. It's a new way of thinking about it. And we're trying to align our outlook with the outlook of the Buddha. That is really what we're trying to do here. We're seeing things in a new way. We're understanding the severe limitations of the five sense world. And we're moving the mind over to the spiritual realm instead, finding that happiness, finding that security, finding the refuge within ourselves instead of finding it without. That is really what this is about. And from this arises all this beautiful path of meditation, as I mentioned before. All the joys, all the happinesses, everything you ever wanted in your life, and far more besides. The five hindrances, the opposite of the five hindrances, are the seven awakening factors. As the five hindrances die down, the seven awakening factors arise. It's like an inversely proportional relationship between the five hindrances and the seven awakening factors. Five hindrances go down, awakening factors go up. What are the awakening factors? Bliss, happiness, tranquility, samadhi, energy, all the things that you ever wanted in your life comes from that. So there you are. That is just some little advice for you. So as you continue on your spiritual practice, hopefully you will continue. Do your meditation practice. And if you feel that you get stuck, these are the areas I recommend you to look at. And if you look in these areas and you start to think about the world in this way, you practice this kind of kindness, I can almost guarantee that you will succeed and that you will move forward as a consequence.